On this side, we'll go through working with actors, the problems of developing voice and character, and we'll hear some comments on post-production. Let's continue with working with actors. Norman Jio talks about dealing with director-actor relationships, and Shelley Carlson adds her opinion.
Now, it doesn't happen in all cases, but I find it happens quite common is that there's going to be that little moment. It may be a little buckle, and maybe a major buckle, particularly when you're working with a major talent. And that's the time to say, I'm directing this, and you're acting it. And don't do a dance with me because we got to get this work done. And that's not, you know, if that person can't get to that, then it's beyond. I mean, you're not going to direct this person. You're not directing this person. You're really going to let them do their thing. And so don't call yourself director at that moment. You're a facilitator. I mean, you may do that. I mean, it depends. But I have found that if you establish that role and you're ready to not, what I want from you is, I don't want to argue with you. I want to do my job. I want you to do this. Can't you just go here or wherever it is and exchange it? They'll respect you for it, and they'll fall in line. Maybe not, but I wouldn't give up that line. That's a heavy, I call it the buck. Other times it's a lot more lightweight, less challenging, but what it gets down to is like there's this human spirit, it seems like, that actors a lot of times embody, because they're so close to their emotions, or should be, that it's like riding a stallion that's never been ridden before. And if you don't expect it to do a little jump, you know, you might as well go down to the little carousel in the park and get on the back of, you know, one of the little ponies. But don't call that riding.
For you to say something simply like, well, look, you can't get off mic. You know, you got to stay on the mic here. I mean, you can't be looking at this guy and getting off the mic all the time. Well, all that is, well, there's two things about that. First of all, it's a negative, it's a criticism right from the top. So it's like, no, I'm not doing this well. No, I don't care. I'm sick of doing this anyway. It's not like real acting anyway. I mean, you approach things in a negative, you usually get that same negative back. So instead, find out what it is that is bugging him. And there again, it might be something real simple that you can compensate for, like, well, I can't see the other actor and I hate that. Well, maybe we can put him across from you. Or maybe the other actor doesn't have dialogue with the actor who's speaking then, but the other actor feels like he needs his physical presence. So then maybe you can stage it so that indeed he is visually relating to him, so that he feels like he's not just playing to the mic.
Now, Shelley and Vanessa Whitburn talk about ways to find depth and detail in the characters and how the production, script, and schedules can affect the actors.
Find the beginning, the middle, and the end. Now, as simple as that may seem, observe how the action builds and don't play the end emotion at the beginning of the play. So I've got an example written in here about Ophelia. What is Ophelia about? Oh, Ophelia is about a sad girl who goes crazy, right? All right, well, now that may be what happened to Ophelia in the end, but in the beginning, she's a wealthy young girl in love, right? So it can be more of a problem than you'd think to have an actor come in and play the end at the beginning. Okay, now again, you shouldn't have that problem with well-trained actors, but indeed, if you're working with a more amateur actor or somebody who's making the crossover, or again, teenagers, that's something you really want to watch out for. And by making sure that they understand that dramatic action has a beginning, a middle, and an end. In almost every play, each character, even if it's a small character, has some transformation that happens to them, so that they are not the same person at the beginning of the script that they are at the end of the script.
So if, for example, you've got a play which is in the psychiatrist's chair and then it goes into flashback and about why are they in this state, well, why not put all the psychiatrist's chair scenes together and do them with the actor and the actress concerned so that they can focus on it? Okay, take a tea break, take lunch break, don't drive them into the ground, but do them all together and then do your flashback scenes separately. Mm-hmm. Because they're in a different time scale. Whereas if you plod from page 1 to 2 regardless, you're going to be saying, right, now we're back in the psychiatrist chair and the actor's come in. Oh, yeah, but I've just done a scene where I was 10 years old. Oh, yeah, yes, dear, but you're now 35 and you're in the psychiatrist chair. It is so much cleaner, so much easier to say, let's do all the 35-year-olds sitting in the chair at once. Get that out of the way. Let's do the 10-year-old and the 6-year-old. Or you might decide to do it the other way around, because you might say, I want to give the actors to work through this experience rather than know what the hell's putting in the psychiatrist's chair. So think a little bit, little bit like that about a play. If you're going to do it in bits, then be aware that you have total control of pace. Total, because the actor is disoriented, particularly if you're doing it out of order. I mean, some of them, if they're very, very clever, will be helping you. The good actors will be helping you, but you cannot rely on that. And why should you rely on it? You are the one that has got to keep control of that pace. Now, if it is a play which has got a deep psychological development, which works in real time or in very close time, like Othello, Shakespeare's Othello, which all happens over 3 days, and everything is very compressed, and the essence of it is that Othello is being driven mad with jealousy because he is not given time to think by Iago and Roderigo, and everything's crowding in on him, or a modern play like that, Death of a Salesman or something, where everything's happening, then you might decide that it's going to help the actors to do it in big chunks. So we have done plays, modern plays, where we have done 10, 20, 30 page scenes in order that the actor gets a kind of continuity and a kind of a feel for it. And that can help, and they then help to control the pace, of course, of what's happening, which is marvellous.
In radio, we don't have the physical. So the audience doesn't know that the actor who just, you know, quote, entered is a beautiful blonde, you know, is a degenerate bartender. We don't have that physical quality. So we need, that's where the characterization part of it comes in, right? And this is not simply things as broad as a Southern accent, right? Okay, now because those are actually easier to use. I mean, if you've got an accent, that can cover a lot of ground. Or if you've got somebody that uses a particular idiomatic type of speech, well, then right away we can identify them as soon as they open their mouth. So characterization has to do with things that are a bit more subtle.
I don't think it is a good thing, although I have done it, every director has done it, to line read. To go in and say, no, what I mean is, well, I hate you! I don't think it's a good thing for lots of reasons. One, because I'm a bad actress. I wouldn't cast myself. Two, because there is never one right way of saying a line. And it comes from, the right way of saying a line comes from an emotional thought. Through thought. If thought is right, a line will be right. One person says, I hate you, in a different way to another person says, I hate you. And it isn't necessarily to punch the hate or the you. So what you're doing in giving a line reading is a rather nonsensical thing.
Say you're having trouble getting your thoughts across to the actors. Norman makes this suggestion. And then Shelley will give us a very specific exercise for working with actors.
Here you are, and this is classic. I don't articulate well. Well, probably in certain circumstances you can articulate well. Well, right. For the circumstances. Here is what you're saying. This is a very nebulous way to communicate. I find that metaphors are the best way.
Mm-hmm.
And you have to go there. And so maybe you have to improve your ability to communicate within metaphors, and then you wouldn't be saying, I don't know how to articulate. I mean, get it down to a science. A metaphor is something that you can clearly identify with. Let's use it as a building block. Yeah, absolutely. But they hear that. And particularly on the top of a scene that already is out of context, out of life, out of reality, yet based on some portion of reality that the actor knows best, the director's got to grab at. I mean, what a better situation for a metaphor than that.
And that's where the who, what, where, when, and why can be a really good, basic way to get that format rolling so that you make it very specific. Let's say you're doing a script that might be a contemporary script, and so you want to find out, well, who are you? And then have your actor be very specific back to you. Or you as the actor, don't just make it, I'm a housewife from Kansas. That's not good enough. It's got to be, I'm a housewife from Kansas who is such so many years old, and I've had this kind of background, so that it's specific in your mind's eye. Because that specificity will come out in your performance and make the performance specific, which is what makes things much more alive and will give you an alive, bright performance, so that you're much better off if you're having trouble with somebody to approach it from a very specific format. And this is one that works real well, this who, what, where, when, and why. Then if you go on to what, you know, be very specific about that and with the concentration. Well, what is the problem? I mean, it depends on what the script considerations are here. What is the problem? What are you trying to solve here? So that you can use basic sort of motivational questions. What do you want? What's standing in your way? Then you go on to the next one, where? Where are you? Very important for a radio studio. I mean, where are you? I'm in the radio studio. Well, yes, that is where you are. But in your mind's eye, you want to make sure, where is your actor? In your mind's eye, are you in the woods? Are you in a bar? Are you in an expensive restaurant? Are you in a hamburger joint? Now, those things can really make a big difference in terms of the performance having a specific quality to it. And that's one that you can have really get everybody involved with if you're having trouble with that. Because with a script, you do want everybody to be in the same place, right? Then when does it take place? Now, that can be something that can solve problems, especially working with less experienced actors and children in terms of what if you're doing something that has to do with a period piece, right? So that indeed people speak a little bit differently and use language differently in 1920 than they do in 1980 or in 1880 as opposed to 1980. So you can have some discussion about that, but keep it specific. Well, how do you talk to your grandmother when you go to visit her as opposed to how do you talk to your friends? And you can use that even with adult actors. How do you relate to somebody when you're in a bar, as opposed to how do you relate to somebody when you're trying to get a job? The next one, why, and sharing with the actor, can be two of the most important things that end up. But if you go through it from that point of view of the first, who, what, where, when, by the time you get to why, which is why am I doing this? Because you hired me, right? Okay, then it's a little more specific. Why are you doing this? Because I've got across the Rocky Mountains to get to where my dad lives, okay? So now if you've gone through each one of those, you should be able to get a real specific answer from your actor there. And then make the point about sharing with the actor. Now this is something that even with good actors who are used to working on stage can really be a problem because they're used to looking somebody in the eye, for one thing, when they're talking to them, and you can either have the problem of if they relate to the actor visually, then they're off mic all the time. See, now that's a big problem, right? Because then every time they get excited or there's something going on, they turn their eyes and their mouth to look at the actor and have a meaningful visual glance, and they're off mic, right? So you really have to get that sharing with the actor and encourage them that now you're going to, that of course their body and their emotions are into it, but that the vocal aspect is the most important. So if they can just stay on the mic and put all the emotion there, that's great.
Here, Norman Gio discusses his ideas of using a chorus of actors for visual and audio effect.
I like to take radio drama and stage it and highlight the art form itself. So I try to take that out, projecting across the audience's heads and stage and choreograph the actors' movements, maybe pick them up with wirelesses so they're free and EQ those voices on stage, and basically go back and forth in the environment and try to capture it inside the theater.
Listen to City Desk by Mark Shepard and hear how the foreground works with the background voices.
This is a fully involved apartment tower for 5519 Michigan.
Oh, my God. That's my address. That's my building. Jennifer, I got to get out of here. Melissa, who can we get besides Maypole?
Just Maypole.
Oh, great. Just get him up here.
Maypole to the City Desk. Bob Maypole.
Jane, what am I going to do? Nelson!
Yeah?
We got a big fire here.
Okay, where is it?
5519 Michigan. Who's up?
Well, Laser. I can get Laser on it, and Keith is already in his car.
Okay, send him. Hey,
what's
Beam?
The address again?
5519 Michigan. Hey, Beam!
All right.
Yeah.
Beam!
Yeah,
you
what?
Work the horn and do rewrite. I'm sending Maypole.
We just got some wire photos
okay.
in there.
Okay,
good. Just put them over on the desk.
Wait a minute. 5519 Michigan. Isn't that your place?
Yeah, that's my place.
Now, listen in as Norman gives an opinion on Beyond the Subway, adapted by Norman Gio from a piece by Jeff Pearson, and then listen to the results.
I think they got to be pushed a lot harder at this stage. And I think that in a role as a director, you could have pushed them and shook them up a little bit, particularly in the tone of the scene. Now, this was a sensitive scene that was going to be calling for a great deal of sensitivity. You may put on a velvet glove and come in here and try to milk those emotions out of your actors. But right now you got a subway. I would have gone in here to find emotions within there that equated to rage.
Right.
Because people who are in a subway intimidating an innocent person like this have got to have some rage that's misguided.
Here's this old bag lady can't even get up to see the light of day.
Get out of my way! I gotta get off!
someplace else. Will somebody help me? I don't know where I am.
I'll help you. Move over, jump.
Okay, all right, no problem.
Yeah, problem. Get out of my face, face. To the end of the train and take this garbage bag lady with you, man.
Just let her sleep.
No way. I'm not going to let her sleep. I'm going to paint her face.
Hey, wake up. Move it. Okay, come on, you turtle. Stick your head out of that bag.
Thank you, Lola. Can't you get up?
No, no. Hey, guys, let's take her shoes and paint her feet.
I'm not going to touch her. Say, what you writing on her back?
Loser!
Loser,
you stink. You haven't abandoned years.
All right, leave her alone. She hasn't done anything to you. How'd you like somebody to spray paint you when you're down and out?
Say what?
Don't you have any sense? Stop it.
So who is she to you? You're a mama?
Mama, baby.
Mama boy. Chump of the month. Wait, look at this now. See how fine I can stroke this cross on her forehead. Too fine for words. I am an RD.
Here, I'll show you how to do it.
Hey, watch it. You get that on me.
Get out of the way. I'm doing her mouth.
That's it.
Hey, he's got it out. The pocket's down. What's this crack? It's
hey, stop it.
What you got?
Give me that back.
Bubblegum. Breathe hard there. Oh, that's not a wallet. It's a purse.
$5.
Hey, give that back.
No way, man. You just bought a genuine certified bag lady.
What if you're not getting what you want? Shelley Carlson gives us a few ideas.
Turn off the recorder and stage it. I mean, if you're really having problems, that can be a very good break. Everybody's getting uptight. They're not getting it right. They know they're not getting it right. So just turn everything off and say, well, let's try this. You know, let's just do it on the floor here in a small way. And simply stage it the way they would on stage. And for one thing, you can break a pattern that's going on, a false kind of intonation that they've adopted for themselves, because now that you've gone over it 3 or 4 times. Where are you going? All right, so he said that the same way, like 16 times, right? And you want to get something else. Well, then use a stage technique. Tell one of the actors, as a matter of fact, you can use this, which works very well, where you whisper a set of instructions to one actor and don't tell the other actor. So let's say it's a two-person scene between two 16-year-olds, and the one 16-year-old wants to find out information from the other 16-year-old, and he's been giving you a real phony reading of, where are you going? You know, that's not at all what you're looking for, right? Now, you've done it 16 times, so take the one actor and say, go out of the room. And let him start to walk for the door and tell the other actor, now I want you to, no matter what he does, I want you to get him to stay with you. And you'll break a pattern of, where are you going? Into, where are you going? Where are you going? Where are you going? So that you break that pattern of that, well, I can't say it any differently. And set up something just because you physicalized it. And that can be very helpful. Let's say that you're having trouble with a scene that is indeed very much in an atmosphere that doesn't have anything to do with a radio studio, right? Let's say it's supposed to take place in the woods, and you're just not getting the feeling that you want there. This is where you can use a real specific feeling of memory of emotion, so that it's not just, well, what do you feel like when you're in the woods? Well, I feel great. The sunshine feels good. It's really a lot of fun, right? Instead, use a technique where you go over it, again, very specifically, so that you feel like, what did I feel like when I was in the woods the last time? And you can use an old physical exercise of starting from the toes of your feet and work up to the top of your head. What kind of clothing, what kind of shoes did I have on? Usually be a much different pair of shoes than you'd wear to be walking in the city or to be going out to lunch or going out to dinner. How does that affect that you weigh the way that you walk? How does that affect the way that you feel? Because eventually that's going to affect the way that you use your voice. Because as you know, when you have tennis shoes on, you get this, you know, like bouncier aspect, right? Which eventually, like, you know, goes into your voice, right? And when you've got high heels on, you're like a serious person for a woman, right? Uh-huh. Or a man, wingtips, whatever the alternative is there, so that you've got a much more serious, and that tends to go into your voice too. So that although this seems like it's not applicable for radio, it really can be very applicable and make it very specific for your actor. So you can do that exercise, and then what kind of clothes do you have on? Well, you know very well that you feel different in blue jeans than you do in a three-piece suit. which does eventually go into the way you use your voice. And here's an example, a good stage actor who you've got playing, let's say he's supposed to be playing an uptight stockbroker type, right? And somehow you're just not getting that from him. It's like we've got hippy-dippy time here or something, right? So why aren't you getting that? Well, perhaps on stage, as soon as he gets that suit on, he's the uptight stockbroker, right? But he's there in the radio studio in his blue jeans. And so he doesn't have that added dimension, so you're having trouble getting that from him. So that's where you want to use this real specific feeling of imagination. You know, have him put on a suit jacket for you, like a mime, like a pantomime or an improvisation. Have him stand the way that he stands with a suit jacket on and see if that doesn't indeed make a difference in the way that he chooses to use his voice and language.
Norman Jio, Vanessa Whitburn, Mark Decker, and David Osman give some tips on what they listen for and how they pull the script, the actors, the engineers, and the sound effects into a complete production.
Hear the play because you will make certain decisions in studio which are to do with how you hear the play. And there's nothing worse than coming out and editing the play, mixing the play or editing it, and saying, oh, I wish I had more train at the front of that scene because I can't do that crossfade now, can I? You see? So unless you hear the whole thing, you might make the wrong decisions in studio. So hear it in your head, and if necessary, especially when you start, write it down.
If you can get your crew interested, your technicians interested,
Artistically, as well as technically.
I mean, if you can get them the script and get them involved in it, and part of getting them involved, I think, is not just coming down and saying, there's the script you need, a door open on that page you need, no. Some birdies singing on that page, and there we have... Let them read the script and say, I noticed that we've got a door. Now, is that an interior door or is it an exterior door? Because it's not quite clear from the script. And they were, if you can get them involved in it, they're prepared to throw things in.
Yeah.
And I get that from my colleagues, my junior colleagues, who are doing the recorded effects and that sort of thing.
Let them read the script.
They'll read the script and they'll throw ideas in. Yeah. And they'll say, look, there's a night scene here. Wouldn't it be nice to have a dog barking off in the distance?
As a producer, you can say yes or no.
You can say no. In the script. Mm-hmm. But it might just create that slightly eerie feeling of being alone in a strange city and there's a dog barking off in the
distance. Lovely, if it's a quiet little scene, you know?
It sound effects drama that is as important as any of the dialogue. And there's any number of ways of taking it. And there's the perspective. Is it close? Is it far away? Are people watching it? Or are we just listening to it? Are we in the actor's mind? Or are we standing back in a crowd of amazed people? And all of this perspective needs to be addressed so you have the strongest possible scene, sound effects-wise, and not something where you're trying to make one wimpy sound work. But a complex of sounds which leads up to this dramatic episode.
Sometimes it's right, and it's right for all kinds of elusive reasons, and you don't have the time in radio drama to try and break down why it's right. Because the big difference is, you are not, what you're doing is trying to capture something on tape, that elusive moment that works. You're not trying to say, and can we reproduce this tomorrow exactly the same, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, and tomorrow, which is what you have to do in the theatre. So very often in the theatre, you're trying to kind of find out exactly why does a thing work in order that you can reproduce it time and time again for 6 months, 3 months. But on the radio, you capture that elusive moment on tape, and you got it. Doesn't matter if they all say, I mean, I've got actors saying, oh, I don't know what I was doing. I don't. Was that any good? And if I'm happy, I'll say, it's lovely. They can listen to it later and decide whether they're going to work with me again.
No editing. No. Do not edit voice tracks. Do not edit voice tracks. This is all that meticulous, horrid work of post-production is going in and editing your analog voice tracks. I do takes. I get a scene, just like a movie. You get a scene. And there's not a lot or almost no intercutting in what I do. I do not take lines. I do not retake lines. I take scenes. And this means that I can start a scene and punch the button and it's up there on the multitrack without the hours and hours of meticulous editing. I'd rather have the flubs that happen in real life. I'd rather have that real life on the tape than I would have something that's artificially constructed. Now, you will not find a lot of directors who do that. I mean, that's unique to my style, I think.
I'm very Hitchcockian in my approach, and other people are very loose. But I believe, I mean, Hitchcock said, paraphrasing, he hated to do the movies. So I hate to make the film, because I've seen it. Yeah. I mean, that says a lot. If you've seen it already and you like the film, are you able to go ahead? Everything is editing, right? Everything up to the point of final commitment is editing. You're editing constantly. You're editing from the script. You're editing and editing and editing and editing, editing people. Don't say it like this, say it like this. You're editing effects. It's all a big pain in the ass for a tape sequence. It's editing. It's just editing. So you're right. I mean, I like the flow, and I wouldn't want to give up the flow. So what do I use? I use a cheap $400, $500, $1,000 four-track, you know. Mm-hmm. And I edit. I edit the mix. I edit the concept. I put it. I take the section, and I say, okay. No, that feels good. I do that segment. That's got enough breathing room. I see it. I feel it. Oh, if I had two more seconds. There comes a point when you know if you gave it two more seconds, it should be right. Mm-hmm. Go back, dub it down, feel it, and just that section. It looks good. It's all cassette. And then come back in and cut your guide track so that when you walk in that environment, it's just tape. Even if it's in a community-based station where you've got a four-track, you're still going to be competing against somebody that's going to be late and getting out before you, and somebody wants to be in there after you, unless you work all night. And if you work all night, you don't want to be in there with a headache. You want to get it done.
Finally, Vanessa and Marjorie.
I am the one to judge. If it's fine, it's fine. Let's leave it. Let's move on. So you're dealing with lots of elusive things. You're judging the thing as you go. The other thing is, gut reactions are worth trusting. When you listen to a piece, don't like it. Do like it. Note that down, because you can persuade yourself of a lot of things, you know. I mean, you can say, oh, well, no, I think it's all right. I mean, you know. But if you have this gut reaction, it's like, ooh, don't like it. It's probably not very good. And same with I like it, too. It probably is good. Again, and so trust those first reactions. Okay, if you've got the time, do it again if you think you have a go. But keep that tape that you think you liked, so that when you're editing and listening to it in calmer circumstances, you can really decide that you probably like it. I find that 85 to 90% of my decisions that I make in the studio are I stick to in the editing later. I do not listen to everything again. If I say, use take three, I may very well have take one and two on tape, but I don't very often listen to them because I've done it for years, and I find that if I do listen to them, I still take three. Nine times. I mean, sometimes, if I'm unsure, I'll put listen in capital letters. Which means, Vanessa, you are not sure which take you like, or whether perhaps you like half of take one and half of take two, so you better listen to them more. But if I'm sure in studios I'm listening, this is the take that works, I put use take two.
Radio is used in such a way, there are not handles on the radio. People don't sit in front of it like they did in the 1930s or 40s. Mostly they don't. Every moment of it has to be interesting for itself. And you have to build in little doors all the way through your piece that people can enter into it because they're going to tune in the middle. I personally believe in keeping the audience with you in every way that you can. And that's where real talent comes in, is the ability to do that. It's real hard. That's why radio is hard in some ways, because you have to keep everybody with you and as well as be interesting and creative with it. It's not easy.
We hope this tape has helped and challenged you as a radio theater director. Remember, listen, listen, listen. Our thanks go to Marjorie Van Haltren, Vanessa Whitburn, Norman Gio, David Osman, Skip Peasy, Tom Lopez, Shelley Carlson, Mark Decker, and Michael Dalby for their participation in MRTW workshops. For more on directing, we invite you to listen to the MRTW Director as Producer Getting Started cassette. The Midwest Radio Theater Workshop is funded in part by the National Endowment for the Arts, the Missouri Arts Council, the City of Columbia Arts Commission, and KOPN FM Radio. MRTW is directed by Diane Huneke and is located at 915 East Broadway, Columbia, Missouri, 65201. This cassette was produced and edited by Brian Price, and I'm Roger Studi. Thanks a lot, and let us know how your future productions go.